Hello, everyone. This is Cassie Burns, co-founder of All Your Data. I'm an attorney who's been using AI and machine learning for 10 years. I love data and love talking to people about data, and that's what this podcast is about. Each episode of Cassie and will feature a new guest. Each guest comes from a different background with a different approach and attitude towards technology. We'll talk about their experiences and hopefully we'll learn a thing or two. Thanks for joining. Let's get started with Cassie and Anthony Gallo. Anthony, thank you so much for joining us here today in this new episode of Cassie and. So, Anthony, I met you through a colleague of mine at King & Spalding. You are legal counsel for a cybersecurity company called Checkpoint, and we really connected on what it's like working in-house and thoughts about the use of AI in the legal profession. So, Anthony, thank you so much for joining me here today.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to do this. And we connected through a really good colleague of yours, and he's a great person, and I really appreciate him connecting us and getting me on here for your podcast.
Well, before we dig into too many of the topics that I know we want to talk about, I'd love for you to share your background to the audience. Again, I know you're working in-house. That can mean a lot of different things. So maybe share what you do and how you got there.
Sure. So I didn't take the traditional route of going to college and then going right to law school after that, right? And so I didn't really know I wanted to be an attorney until about a year after I graduated college. And so I went into the workforce and I was working in sales over in New York City for a marketing company or a marketing technology company. And I just had a realization one day that I wanted to do more with myself, right? I wanted to kind of help more and just make a name for myself. And I didn't really feel like I was getting that in sales. So just randomly decided one day, law school seems like the perfect option. I went to the Charleston School of Law in Charleston, South Carolina. I was a January start, so most law students do the traditional August start and you graduate 3 years later. I started in January and went through the summer. The problem with me was that I went to law school right before the pandemic started. So my law school was pretty much the Zoom School of Law, and it was like that for 2 years until our third year when it was finally back in person. But it was an invaluable experience, even though it was mostly online, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. After law school, I went back to the company where I was working for sales for and joined their in-house team. And I was specializing mostly in commercial side agreements, so I was doing mostly the sales side. Vendor side was held out of Europe. And I gained invaluable experience there. You know, I learned a lot from my mentors there and a lot of my coworkers, and was there for about a year and a half before making the jump over to Checkpoint, where I am now. And I can't even tell you how much I've learned being at Checkpoint. I just came across my 1 year anniversary about a week ago, and it's been one of the best years of my life here. I've met some of the greatest people. I work with some of the smartest minds that I could ever come across. And I just the people I've met from working at Checkpoint too, such as you and our colleague at King & Spalding, it's just these routes I don't think would have ever been possible to me had I not came to Checkpoint. And so it's just such a great place to be. And the amount I've learned is incredible.
You and I have some things in common, and we talked about it just briefly before we started recording. But I think that you had a very fairly chaotic law school experience that was not probably what you envisioned when you started. And I similarly had a chaotic law school experience. And as I was telling you before, I went to Tulane and I was there my last year of law school when Hurricane Katrina hit. And so I had to deal with evacuating and thinking you're going to be gone just for a little bit. And then, wow, I'm not going to be able to go back this semester. And what do I do? And that was probably the same thing you dealt with COVID. You didn't know how long the lockdown was going to take. And as chaotic as that was and as disruptive as it wasn't ideal in many ways to be in that situation. I feel like it created a resiliency of life is not going to be perfectly planned out. There are going to be some weird things that kind of come in your path that you're going to have to learn to navigate and be okay with that. And I find in my own practice, It lets me deal with, it helps me roll with the punches better. Have you experienced that as well, Anthony, where this wasn't the ideal, but I've learned so much from having gone through that?
Yeah, I mean, 100%. It kind of teaches you, especially going to law school during COVID, taught you adversity, right? Because starting law school and going 6 weeks in person, it's night and day compared to college and law school, right? College, you can just wake up and go to class and no one really prepares and studies and all that. Law school is vastly different, right? You have to read. You're going to get cold called. You have to know the cases that you're learning in the case books. And so you kind of get yourself into a rhythm, right? So that whole first 6 weeks of law school, it's more like, all right, when am I going to do my readings? When do I have time to go to the gym? When do I have time to play golf, right? Because you want to keep yourself mentally fit, right? You have to. I mean, law school is one of the most stressful times of someone's life. And so you really have to make sure that you make that time for yourself. So 6 weeks later, we're on spring break and COVID is just starting to come into the United States and everything. And then we get an email saying we're going to be on Zoom for a week. So now it's like, okay, well, it's 1 week. You don't really have to change everything, right? Then 1 week became 2 weeks. 2 weeks became the end of the semester. And next thing, 2 years, we're all online. And so you get into this rhythm of my first 6 weeks, I was just starting to find out, like, this is what works for me. And now it's flipped upside down, right? Now I'm sitting at my desk having to attend classes on Zoom. You don't really feel as engaged because you're not sitting there face to face. You don't really have the little butterflies in your stomach about getting cold called on because, you know, it's just a different feeling. And so you really, like, that was an early time in my legal career. And yes, law school really kicks off your legal career. It was an early time to face adversity like that. But, you know, those adversaries, they make you who you are, right? And so I think the person I am today and the type of attorney I am today all comes because having to flip-flop that quickly in just the way that I operate to become a Zoom student, right? And it's mm-hmm. a lot of people dealt with that in the education and even in law firms as well, right? I mean, you go into the office every single day and now it's, what do I do? I'm not going into an office. How am I supposed to do all my hours just sitting here like this?
Well, and I think that networking is a big piece to it as well. And I would imagine that another thing we have in common is we both work remotely. And I enjoy that in a lot of ways. I am more introverted. But I also realize it's very important to be proactive and reach out and make those connections. Like, I don't want to work in a vacuum. And so I would imagine that having gone through that Zoom experience, like, you make of the experience what you decide to make of it. And so you could just kind of passively go through and attend classes or work remotely, or you can be very proactive and make those connections, build those connections. So even if you're not down the hall from someone, you're really building up a rapport for people. And I would imagine in some instances, like, having dealt with that in law school probably prompt you for, like, realizing I have to go out there and build those connections.
I completely agree. And LinkedIn somewhat became my best friend during that time, right? Because you're right. Networking is so tough to do when you're just sitting behind a computer all day long. And I kind of just went to LinkedIn because I knew very on, probably after my 1L year, I would say it was my 1L year when I realized I don't really want to do litigation. I don't even know if I really want to work in a law firm. And so Charleston's it's a beautiful city, but it's not a big built out corporate law city. A lot of the firms here are small boutique firms that'll do real estate, personal injury, things like that. And so being someone who decided early on that I needed to go into corporate law and that's what I really wanted to do, I had to turn to LinkedIn. And so that's where I start to build a lot of connections on there, just trying to connect with all the in-house attorneys that I possibly could in the space, to really just introduce myself, right? Put my name out there and try to get them to know me, pick their brain a little bit on things that got them to where they are. Because it's not a traditional route to go straight from law school to corporate law or to an in-house role. And so most people think you kind of have to fight your battles doing back-end work at a law firm before you make the jump to in-house. But I think the world has changed a little bit in that. And I think it's okay to go straight in-house now. And personally, I think I learned more going in-house because what happens is, you know, you go to a law firm and you might become an expert at one small, minute area of the law. But when you're an in-house attorney, it's not like that. You're a generalist. You have to know a little bit about everything and you have to know enough about everything that you're protecting the company that you work for. And so it kind of makes you a little more nimble. There's a lot more hats you have to wear when you go in-house. And so I learned really quickly once I started my first in-house job that this is exactly where I want to be, right? This is where I'm going to be able to put boots on the ground, just become a sponge early in my legal career and absorb everything that I possibly could from any source that I have. And it really helped make me and shape me to be the person that I am today.
And I think that I, similar to you, we have so many things in common, Anthony. I went right in-house right out of law school, and a bit unusual, but I feel like it helped me learn the business approach. You understand this is my legal advice. This is what I would recommend, but also realizing there are other levers for business considerations that come into play. And going back to the whole like COVID and being agile and having to kind of roll with the punches, you have to realize that you have to navigate those waters. They're not so clear cut as what we kind of are presented in law schools. It's learning kind of how to navigate, how to be persuasive to your business colleagues, and also understand that you're not the final decision maker in some things, and seeing that perspective can help with your communication style and how you present things. So one thing I would love to talk to you about, Anthony, and I know that we've talked about this before, AI is generally something everyone's talking about. It's obviously a focus of many of my podcast episodes. And I think maybe 20 years ago, the thought of going in-house was kind of like, oh, it's pre-retirement nearly. It's easy, banker hours. And that's really not the case anymore. And maybe it never really was. But I, having worked in-house and having friends who work in-house now, I see that there is increasingly more expected of them without the expanded headcount and without more hours in the day coming. And I see a great benefit to generative AI with the proper controls in place to really get some of that life back to in-house counsel, because anything over 40 hours is kind of like free. You know, it's not like maybe some law firms where you might get compensated for your total hours. So what are your thoughts on how that could help out your life, Anthony?
So I think that's a two-part question too, right? I think the first part to address is the working more hours, right? And I think a lot of this new trend of no one in the legal space, whether it's in-house or private firm, no one's really working a 40-hour work week. I think that has a lot to do with this shift in that a lot of in-house attorneys are working from home, right? It's not like you go to an office, you sit at a desk all day, you do your work, and then once you get in the car or on a train to go home, it's like, I'm not dealing with something until tomorrow. The laptop is closed. Now, a lot of us that work in-house and that work from home, we live 10 feet away from our desks, right? And so you get something at 8 o'clock at night and you're like, all right, this will take me 5-10 minutes. Let me do this right now and I don't have to worry about it tomorrow. So you kind of like the hours kind of tack on when you're working from home. And I think a lot of the big problem with that too is there's a lot of burnout now in-house that might not have happened previously. And I'm not saying that I myself have burned out yet. I think I might be too young in my career to get through that. So we'll see maybe in 5 or 10 years. But it just, the hours start to accumulate the more times you say, okay, this will only take me 10 or 15 minutes to do. Let me do it now, right? Instead of going out to grab a bite to eat, instead of hanging out with some friends, let me just work on this real quick. And then 8 o'clock becomes 10 o'clock. And that's how you get to your 80-hour work weeks. So I think that's really the first part to address in terms of maybe why attorneys in-house, it's not really a 40-hour work week anymore. I'm sure there's unicorns that are out there, but it's almost tough to do that nowadays. Second part, generative AI, you are absolutely correct. It is kind of taking the world by storm within the last 5 years, maybe even less than that. And I think it's very beneficial, but I might take a little different spin on generative AI. I think it's, for every powerful tool that it has, I think there's also a negative tool that's with that, right? And so, for example, working in the cybersecurity space, right, you can see all the great benefits that generative AI can bring, right? It can detect malware, does a lot of coding for you, it can exploit vulnerabilities, it can find hacking and trace codes that are patterns to hackers. But with all those powerful tools, all it takes is one smart person who is a cyber criminal to reverse engineer that And now they can find and get use generative AI to find hacking that won't come through that, right? And create deep fakes and things like that. And they have things that can avoid malware detection. So I think there's a lot of give and take with the use of generative AI, especially in cybersecurity. And that comes with the vast array of privacy concerns that we haven't even talked about yet. But I think it's a really great tool, but I think it sits in sort of a gray zone in the law where everyone's just waiting for someone to come out with some type of legislation that's on generative AI that can point us one way or another, especially with licensing too. And licensing is a very big issue in AI. And no one really knows, right? It's kind of like some companies maybe want to get ahead of it and take a faster approach to it. The company I'm currently at, we're a little more risk averse. So I think we're in the wait and see mode almost of like, what really is the benefit here? And does the benefit truly outweigh the risk, right? We might be able to see the benefits, but I don't think anyone truly knows the risks right now associated with use of generative AI.
Yeah. And I think that the point you make about there are benefits that come with it, but there's potential harm that comes with it. I feel the same way. In some ways with e-discovery, they're of course talking about using generative AI and e-discovery, which I think is a natural progression. We've been using AI for a while anyway. Of course, cybersecurity has this as well. To me, the benefit of using it will get gains potentially in productivity, but knowing that our data sources that we have to collect from and review are increasingly becoming more challenging, more diverse, more difficult. And so even though we may get some gains on that end, we'll have more difficulties and challenges in other areas that will still make all of this very complex. But I would like to talk a little bit about you are part of your practice is reviewing contracts, as I recall. I know that you've talked about that before. And I feel like that there is the potential there and love to hear your thoughts. Again, a very good friend of mine works in-house dealing with contracts, and it never fails that salespeople want a contract review and edited on a Friday night, ASAP, time kills deals, that kind of a thing. Where do you see AI fitting in that? Or are you still kind of in a wait and see mode with that as well?
So I think it's a little bit of both. You know, for example, I was on a demo call yesterday and I saw this tool that it uses generative AI to actually do the redlining for you. Right. And so my mind was blown. I had never seen something like this before. It was a really cool tool. Probably cost like $1 million, but that's a different story.
Yeah.
But so it started to make my mind think, right? And the first question that popped into my head was, does this almost rule the common day attorney obsolete? And because, think about it, we spend all our time, we put so many years into going to law school, taking the bar, doing the back end work to really gain all this knowledge that we can to be able to be in a position to negotiate a lot of agreements. And now we have tools that can essentially read my brain within 2 weeks and do the work for me. And so it almost gets to a point where in my head, I'm like, this is a great tool. But is someone going to see this and be like, all right, it already knows pretty much everything that Anthony Gallo knows. Why do we need Anthony Gallo anymore? We have this. And so it's a little bit scary to think how powerful, you know, and we're still in the early stages of generative AI, right? And so it's really scary to think, especially as an attorney, like, will this overtake our jobs, right? And what's the point of essentially having two Anthony Gallos, right? The machine learning Anthony Gallo, which can read anything and understand the way that I'm going to negotiate something, and then having me, the actual person, also doing it. And so it is a little bit terrifying to just see how far AI has come to the ability that this tool could do that, right? And so it's weird. There's no other way to say it other than it was really weird to have this explained to me and for me to be like, is this machine learning tool going to take my job 2 weeks after we implement? Like, it got to that point.
Well, and I think that is the balance of seeing a demo and then actually using it in real life, you know, in my experience. And again, like, these tools are getting increasingly more robust and more better at dealing with diverse data. But You know, I think for anyone that's considering testing it out, try to get a proof of concept and play with it yourself on your own data in a way that's secure and safe, and really see if it's as remarkable as it is demoed. Because sometimes you might find, hey, this will work in these scenarios really well. We're negotiating on my client, on my company's paper. It's a fairly standard agreement, things like that. But you may find that contracts are about relationships and about negotiating terms between two parties. And as so many relationships, they're not always straightforward. And so I would believe that it may be a good first draft, but we're always going to need the human Anthony Gallo in the loop. But
no, you're absolutely right. Absolutely. And so you're right, because it might be able to do the first initial red line and first pass at something. But once you have to jump on a call and start to negotiate and hammer out some of the terms that you're really willing to die on that hill for, no computer's jumping on and taking that call for you, right? No tool is doing that. So you're still going to need that human element to the relationship building, like you said, to be able to close that deal. It was very fascinating to see that something could read your mind like almost within 2 weeks, I think I was told. And you're right. Sales reps might be able to sell you everything under the sun, but once you try it out, it might be a little different. But I mean, this is just one use of AI that's out of a billion different uses throughout this whole world that we can do. And so it's just a little crazy to see how far it's come in such a short time.
Well, especially you're fairly early in your career. It's got to be something that weighs a little bit more heavy in your mind, thinking, why did I do this? If that's what could happen, could I be replaced? I personally don't think it's going to happen, because I think we're going to have maybe time that's taken away is going to be spent on dealing with issues because of AI or because of emerging technologies, or maybe you get a little bit of time back. But I would like to kind of, you know, let's talk a little bit about law school, generative AI, your thoughts on that. I know I have some strong opinions on law school programming or what they focus on, but it's been 20 years since I've been in law school. So I would love to hear what your thoughts are, what you would maybe talk to law school students about as far as where you think generative AI fits into the curriculum and what sort of advice you might give a law school student right now.
I think it could definitely be a powerful tool, but I think any law school student can't get too complacent in the use of it. You can't have generative AI do your job for you, right? It might be a great wingman and might be great to assist you with, but you can't have it start to do the work that you still need to do yourself, right? I mean, any tool you could, if you have to read 5 cases in a casebook for your class tomorrow, for your Civ Pro class tomorrow, generative AI can do that. But are you really truly grasping everything that's in there? I think the best way to do it would be read it yourself, use generative AI to give you a summary, and let it fill in those gaps of the questions you still have, right? Because you don't read something and you're like, this makes perfect sense. That's why we're in law school, right? We read something and then we go and learn about it the next day, and that kind of helps fill in the gaps. So I think if we can use generative AI hand in hand with our own brain power, I think that's where the most powerful use is going to come from. I think I can see it almost getting taken advantage of by people who think it's kind of an easy way out of law school, right? Almost like, I don't need to do all this work because I have this tool that sits behind and does everything for me. I think that's the wrong way to approach it. And as the years go on, it'll be interesting to see if bar passage rates in some states kind of dip a little bit, if maybe some students are using more generative AI than others. And maybe that'll help weed out some of, I don't necessarily want to say lower level talent, but it'll kind of weed out the people that are truly putting in all the effort to learn the law, understand the rules behind things, actually study for the bar exam and be able to pass it, you know, on their own accord, maybe with a little bit of help from generative AI, but not replacing themselves with Gen AI.
I think that's all exactly right. I think that not only law school students, but young attorneys, I know that there's concern across the board, even some state bar associations that have released, you know, guidelines or interim reports have talked about it. What is the potential that there could be a knowledge gap that occurs? And I think part of that is there is a certain muscle memory that occurs from doing rote, boring things. You're going to understand the concepts a little bit better if you do take the time to read everything, which you should for your cases. You should read the cases in full. But you can use, like you said, the generative AI tool to maybe prepare your notes. If you want to have speaker notes to help prepare, if you might get called on or something like that. I feel like that there's a lot of benefit to that. And I feel like that there could be the risk of people just getting very surface level knowledge, because to your point, people see it as an easy button. And if they take advantage of that and don't slow down and go, I really need to like put in the time and build up my muscle, my memory muscles here, they're really just disservicing themselves and how that is used. Because to your point, like, probably going to be hard for you to pass the bar exam. It's probably going to be hard for you to speak in granularity on certain legal issues, or you're going to have some major growing pains when you go to work for a law firm or you go work in-house. Yeah, I think those are excellent points.
And I think with that too, it kind of leads to a little bit of a bigger problem that a lot of young attorneys deal with, and I myself included, is really finding your own voice, right? And that was something I really struggled with early in my career, where, you know, you do all the work and then it's got to get reviewed by someone else. And now it's changed all to their voice and things of that nature. With the use of generative AI in law school, generative AI can write an entire brief for you, right? It can write an entire memo for you. So it kind of takes that aspect away of, this isn't your voice, right? You're not really finding your own voice, using your own vocabulary to get to this point. You're using a machine learning tool that, you know, it's a Gen AI voice, right? That's putting these thoughts behind all the words in on the page. And so that might exacerbate the problem of finding your own voice once you get into the real world. Because say, for example, you use Gen AI all throughout law school, and now you go to a big law firm and they don't allow the use of it. Who are you as a person, right? Like, what is your first memo you got to do for your partner, for your junior partner? What's that going to sound like? What's it going to look like? Is it even going to make sense? Because you don't have this kind of, not necessarily wherewithal, but like, you're not too well versed in formulating a memo that actually sounds like you, right? And so I think that could become a big problem, and you might, you know, have to spend more time finding your own voice within the law. And, you know, like I said, it's a problem that a lot of young attorneys deal with, all right? They deal with imposter syndrome. They deal with not really knowing who they are as an attorney. And I think that's where Gen AI might really hurt any young attorney. And so I think, like I said, it could be a powerful tool. I think it needs to be scaled down a little bit to the terms of like, how much does a law student really want to rely on this tool? Because it could be very powerful. It's as powerful as you make it, but you can't let it be more powerful than you as the individual. Because at the end of the day, you're getting your salary, right? That billable hour, you're getting it. It's not going to a computer, right? So you got to make sure that you actually have an in-house, right? You got to have that business acumen that a generative AI doesn't have, so that you can sell yourself. Because at the end of the day, you have you. And so you got to know, like, you got to have your own voice is what I'm trying to say. And it's a really important aspect in law.
I think that's absolutely right. Because going again to that whole muscle memory concept, one thing that generative AI is great at is it helps people deal with blank document syndrome. I don't know how to get started on this blank document. And I think from my experience, again, 20 years ago in law school, it very focused on writing, but brief writing. And that's not the only writing you're going to do as an attorney. Like, a lot of my writing is internal memos or things to clients. And you really have to navigate, who's my audience? How deep or high level do I need to write this? Like, how persuasive do I need to be? And you have to understand and learn to know your audience and know what that deliverable is. And sometimes you're asked, like, I need you to write this brief or this memo on it with no instructions. And you have to really think, how am I going to organize this in a way that's presented? Because the partner's not going to tell you exactly what they want. The client, the general counsel is not going to tell you exactly what they want. And so if you take those shortcuts to use generative AI to make your life easier, maybe in law school, maybe in your first few years of practicing, you're really cutting yourself short and delaying that learning curve to really be able to again, those muscle memories of, I don't really have white paper blank document syndrome. I know like what I can do to just start like going, but that builds up over time. And if you don't have that rigor and that discipline early on in your career, you're just really limiting, I think, like how quickly you can move forward. So excellent points, Anthony.
And I think the biggest thing too is trust, right? And you're talking about building things, and you really need to build that trust with your general counsel, with your partner. And when you're looking at a blank piece of paper and you might think, oh, I'm going to use generative AI to help me draft this, what trust are you really building as an individual with your superiors? And if they can't trust you without the use of generative AI, then I think we need to take a little self-recollection, say, who really are we without the use of these tools, right? As humans and as attorneys, who are we at our core, right? If we don't have it all stored up here in our head and we have to rely on these other tools, what value do we as individuals really bring to the table? And what trust do we really gain in the people whose trust that we need to gain?
I think, first of all, my dog agrees with you.
mine also does as well.
But I think that's absolutely right. And I think that you'll find that if you heavily rely on those tools for your writing, people are going to probably be able to, it has a certain patina, right? So maybe the answer is not wholesale saying yes or no, don't use generative AI, but these are some great ways to try and use it. But at the core, you're going.
Stop it, Suzu.
At the core, you're going to law school because you are a skilled and persuasive writer and speaker. And think about how you might use it in a way that can make the non-core elements of your career easier, but don't look for shortcuts for those core elements, because at the end of the day, you're just cutting yourself short. So I think that's a great message.
Well, and sometimes those shortcuts might be wrong, right? There was a lawsuit, was it last year or 2 years ago, where someone used ChatGPT to write a memo for them, and it cited cases that never existed. They were not even real cases. And think about almost the embarrassment of being that associate, or even the partner who submitted it on behalf the associate's work. Like, that's a really embarrassing, and that's a big fumble. That is a really,
and that's an ethical violation too. Let's be perfectly honest. As well.
Someone needs to take the MPRE again. But I mean, think about it's the data behind it, where it's very powerful, right? There's a million and billions of data sets behind this, but you still need that human element to verify that the information is accurate, right? All it took was one person to go through and be like, I can't find this case anywhere. I have no idea what this case even is. And boom, you would have caught it ahead of the game. But I think that's where the problem is. It's too much trust in the machine learning, not enough trust in the actual self, right? And so you gotta almost, what was it? Ronald Reagan, I think, said trust but verify. It's you can trust AI, but you need to be able to verify that the information behind it is accurate and factual. Because if there's any place where you have to be accurate and factual, it's the law. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. You have to be accurate.
Well, and I think it goes again to like you still have to validate the results. And whether it's a first year or a summer law clerk, and you have to look, a partner or someone more senior needs to read and sign off on that. We have to do the same thing with the computers. And that's where things like automation bias comes in. You think because a computer created it, it's right. And that's not the case. So I think that there are a lot of, even though, and to me, what I find most compelling about that case is it highlights a problem not with technology, but with the individual, and not using the understanding the technology and using it correctly and fulfilling their ethical obligations. Again, how can you have a brief and not that you cite a case and not try to find the underlying case and read it to make sure you're referencing it correctly? Like, those are some bigger issues than generative AI.
And it would have been funny if that went to trial and the attorney had to speak on a case that didn't even exist and he was asked about it. That would have been hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah. That is not, Not a seat that I want to be in. That's absolutely sure. Anthony, we're winding down at the end. We've had some really great discussions. I would love to hear some of your like closing thoughts, closing advice for young attorneys, be they law students or recent graduates.
I think some of the best advice that I can give a young attorney, and this is particularly for young attorneys that maybe are like me, where they go through a little bit of law school and they say, litigation might not be my route. Maybe I'm not the type of person who wants to go in front of a judge and put on all these theatrics, right, in a trial and things like that. And that might, people might take offense to that who listen to this, right? But I was just that person, right? I knew that wasn't me. And so some of the best advice is don't feel that you have to do it the traditional way of going to a private firm first and then going in-house after. It's not as rare as it once was. And once you finally break into in-house, you'll start to meet people that they all have the same route as you. I've met more people, and some of my closest mentors are the people that took the exact same route as me, because you all struggled in that route together, right? And so the same pains that you came in when you get a contract and you're like, I have no idea what an indemnification clause is. Like, I didn't learn this in law school. You didn't learn it. I mean, the truth is you probably didn't learn what indemnification is in law school. But you kind of go through those struggles with people who are the same as you in terms of they just went from law school straight to in-house. I think another good piece of advice is use LinkedIn. Like, use it. I think it is the best social media platform out there. It's invaluable how many good people are on LinkedIn, whether they're posting all the time, like you, Cassie, right? I mean, I met you through a lot of your posting and colleagues, or whether they're just, they work at a local corporation that's in your town and they're an in-house counsel there. And that might be your first breakthrough if you could do an internship with them. I think finding out early in your law school career that maybe the law firm track and the litigation route isn't what you want to do, go seek those in-house internships. They're there. And they would love to have someone that they can just sit there and train. And that most likely is going to lead to your first job, right? If you find out that that's what you want to do and you want to go in-house, they're going to look back when it comes time to hire and say, this person worked for us this whole summer. They know the ways we operate. They have the business acumen. They made some of these relationships with not just the legal team, but the sales team, the marketing team, the finance team, HR. So they're going to look right at you and say, this is like a shoe-in for this position. And so my biggest advice is don't feel like you have to, and even if all your friends are getting these summer associate positions, if you feel like that's not for you, it's probably not, right? And so don't be scared to really go out and seek those in-house positions. And a lot of those in-house positions are not going to be on like the law school job boards, right? I didn't find any of mine on, I don't even think I remember the name of the law school job board that we used, but nothing was there, right? It was all like personal injury. It was all local. Like me, I knew like, all right, I come from New Jersey and New York. I should look at the corporations up in New York because they probably have in-house attorneys that they're looking to bring on, or they have internships that are open. So don't feel like you have to settle for the job boards on law school. Use LinkedIn. Most of the in-house positions are going to be listed on LinkedIn. There's a lot of great communities on LinkedIn for in-house counsel. I've met a lot through In-House Connect, which is a great CLE program. They're not paying me to say that. but there's a lot of great people that you can network and connect with in the in-house community if you just use LinkedIn. I think it's the most powerful tool as a law school student that you can possibly use.
I completely agree. And I even think as you go on with your career, there's a lot of connections, if you want to build out like people who are practicing the same thing you're doing or similar interests. I think LinkedIn is incredibly powerful and useful. Thank you so much, Anthony. I really appreciate, man, 40 minutes have just gone like that. I appreciate the time, and I really know I've learned a lot from you, and I'm sure my audience has as well. And to my audience, thank you so much for joining us. And join us for the next episode of Cassie and